Hello and welcome to a new episode of Bold Talks, Dialogues and Insight from Southeast Asia, curated by the Heinrich Böll Stiftung. I am Francie, your host, and in this video series, we bring together voices and perspective from across the Southeast Asian region, those who are working toward a more sustainable, just, and inclusive future. We explore ideas that connect people and the Southeast Asia region, from climate resilience to green innovation, from ecological wisdom to sustainability, from gender equity to democracy and human rights. Its conversation is an invitation to reflect on where we are, what is changing, and how we can move forward together. In this episode, I'm talking to Professor Dr. Chanintira Natalang from Faculty of Political Science, Thammasat University, Thailand, about her recent paper, When Nonviolence Fails, The Challenges of Resolving Conflicts in Southeast Asia. Hello, Ajan Chanintira, Ajanin. How are you?
Hi, Francie. How are you?
Yes, thank you for your time and availability, because today we are going to talk about your recent paper, right? But first of all, could you introduce yourself, your position, your background, and share? We are very interested to know what first motivated you to work on foreign affairs, and particularly on peace and conflicts.
Well, first of all, many thanks for having me today. It's quite an honor to talk about my paper and also be given the opportunity to write on this, you know, very interesting subject, which has been a problem for the region for quite some time, right? So I'm a professor of international relations at Thammasat University. This is a university based in Bangkok, Thailand. And as you mentioned, my background is in international relations with a specific focus on peace and conflict in Southeast Asia. So what motivated me is the diversity of this region. So we're very diverse in terms of ethnicity, religion, languages. And so for the viewers who are not familiar with the region, just to give you an idea, in terms of religion, 40% of the Southeast Asian population practice Islam, mostly there in the archipelago states such as Indonesia, Malaysia, and Brunei. Around about 30% are Buddhist. They're predominantly in mainland Southeast Asia. So, for example, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar. And the Catholics are minority in the region, but they're majority in the Philippines and Timor-Leste. So in terms of ethnicity, you know, we have multi-ethnic states, for example, Myanmar, Indonesia. And just to give you an example of how diverse they are, so Myanmar recognizes around about, if I remember correctly, 135 distinct ethnic groups. So that's quite a substantial number. However, there are some groups that have been excluded in the official count. And, you know, I think everybody has heard of the Rohingyas and their plight. So in other words, people of difference, they're not being treated equally. There's been exclusion. And this leads to conflict. This leads to a feeling of ethnic discontent. So just to emphasize, it's not differences that are a causal factor of conflict. It's this this feeling of injustice, exclusion, and, you know, feeling like a second class citizen that, you know, leads to conflict. And so my interest was focus mainly on how do we manage these differences, and when tensions and conflict when they do erupt, how can we resolve this? So that's my answer to the question of, you know, what's my motivation. You did say that, you know, my background is in international relations, right? So I think governments, they prefer to insist that domestic conflicts arising from ethnic or religious differences you know, they like to emphasize that this is a domestic problem. However, they all have international ramifications, or they all have international consequences. So, you know, for example, conflicts can spur migration across borders that affects, you know, neighboring countries. Fighting can affect neighboring countries, you know, or, you know, border villages and all that. So this is where domestic matters and international concerns intersect. And this is why, as a region, we need to be concerned about these conflicts.
Thank you, Achan. This is very interesting. I mean, like, yes, you gave the fact that our region, Southeast Asia, are very diverse, and differences creates conflict if you don't have a proper framework, right? That's why I think we and the audience could learn a lot from your paper. Could you please share some insight? Not all, because we also want everybody to download the e-paper and also to read. But could you share maybe one or two major takeaways from your research paper?
The paper explores the concept of non-violence in dealing with one, interstate conflicts, and two, intrastate conflicts. So I have two large sections dealing with these two problems. So at the minimum, I think when we think of like non-violence, we think of like the idea of not using force to deal with disagreements or tensions or problems. Now, in the paper, what I do is I use a more detailed concept. So this is based on the Global Greens Charter. And so if I can read a sentence from the charter, it defines nonviolence as, you know, striving for a culture of peace and cooperation between states, inside societies, and between individuals as the basis of global security. Okay, so so this means that it goes a bit further than not using force. So it aims to kind of like, let's put it simply, to create a culture, or, you know, like long-term measures. So it's more like more sustainable. And they don't just talk about interstate conflicts or tensions. They also place an emphasis on human security, which I think is, you know, equally important, right? So so based on this definition, I apply this or I engage this definition with what's happening in Southeast Asia. So one section I look at interstate conflicts. Just to expand, you know, academics, policymakers, they believe, and it's, you know, been widely said that ASEAN and Southeast Asia is a successful case in the sense we haven't engaged in major wars since the 1980s. So the last of that war was the Cambodian crisis. And contributing to the success are ASEAN norms, economic cooperation, and multilateralism. Now, it's been widely said that ASEAN norms and institutions have created this, you know, so-called culture of peace and cooperation. However, if you look closely, this has been largely accomplished through conflict avoidance rather than genuine problem solving. So, and, you know, part of the problem, which I guess we'll talk about this later, is the principle of non-interference, right? In light of the renewed tensions between Thailand and Cambodia, ASEAN may need to reconsider how it deals with interstate conflicts, because, you know, obviously this has exposed problems in illustrating the fragility of this approach. Okay, so yes, it has worked to a certain degree, but we need to work further on this, right? Okay, so in terms of ASEAN's commitment to intrastate conflicts, I think it's more problematic. And you know, the principle of non-interference that has kept regional peace or interstate conflicts from exploding like it did during the 1970s and 1980s is the principle of non-interference. But ironically, the principle of non-interference has basically given individual states the authority to decide whether or not to use force or democratic measures to respond to domestic conflicts. So this means that the record has been mixed in terms of the use of nonviolence in domestic conflicts. So obviously, what is happening is violating not only the ASEAN Charter, the Geneva Conventions, but also the principle of non-violence, whatever definition you want to use.
Since you mentioned this ASEAN principle of non-interference, right? So I think this is really could be understood as counterproductive towards the principle of non-violence. According to your view, should this principle be updated? And what might be a better version look like?
People or groups that endorse more democratic principles would say that, yes, that we need to rethink the principle of non-interference. And actually, in the past, there have been some efforts. So I think the most notable would be the proposal from the former Thai foreign minister, but also he was a former Secretary General of ASEAN. So this is Sulin Pitsawan. So in the late 1990s, he proposed flexible engagement. This means that there's flexible engagement to kind of like openly discuss domestic problems of a member state and all that. So move away from that strict adherence to the principle of non-interference. And back then, member states weren't happy about this proposal. So, you know, it was shelved and all that. There's also been proposals to talk about, let me just think of the term, enhanced interaction. And so that means it's a slightly different version of flexible engagement, constructive engagement, in the sense that you can talk about domestic issues, but you're still holding or reaffirming the principle of non-interference. So, you know, some people say, well, you know, that doesn't really work out because, you know, it can be contradictory. So I do think, yes, we need to rethink this, especially when the ASEAN Charter does place an emphasis on the protection of peoples and all that. So, you know, because ASEAN is moving towards a people-centered community, this means inclusivity of the 700 million Southeast Asian peoples of the region, right? So you need to take into account of human security. Now, I don't think the principle of non-interference is the only problem. Another problem is another ASEAN norm, which is the ASEAN way. Now, this means that there's consensus-based decision-making. So if all the members agree, this is, you know, this will become an ASEAN agenda, right? Now, I do believe that this also hinders peace, whether it's peace between countries or peace within countries. And I think a good example would be the 5-point consensus. We've agreed on it, right? More member states, including Myanmar, but we cannot move this forward because half the members are placing importance on the principle of non-interference, and, you know, some members are not. So, part of the problem is the ASEAN way.
So apparently they've been other option towards this principle of non-interference, yeah? You mentioned this flexible engagement and also enhanced interaction. Yes, so there's two. Yeah, but I agree with you. Even to change principle, then you need all 11 member state consent, right? So I think it will be still a long way to go to see whether this principle of non-interference will be changed. Let me move to the next point. When we talk about peace, right, we agree that peace is not merely the absence of war. And in your paper, you mentioned this interstate conflict and also intrastate conflict that basically you cannot touch because this principle of non-interference. But then my question would be, what is it that is required for us in ASEAN to see a sustainable peace? And especially now we are seeing more tension and conflicts return, not only in the global north, but also you see in our region. How would you explain this development for a sustainable peace?
I don't think we're necessarily seeing more conflicts. I think it's a case where old conflicts haven't been dealt with. And also, you see the resurfacing of old conflicts. So, you know, conflicts that have been dormant, but then they have resurfaced just because we tend to avoid conflict resolution. So, you know, we like to sweep problems under the carpet. Yeah. You know, everything's well between us, but not really. So let me give you an example of this. So we, in Thailand, you know, we have a conflict in the south of Thailand, right? So this is a Malay Muslim dominated area. And, you know, this is a conflict that has emerged during the Cold War, and it subsided during the late 1980s because of various various initiatives of the government of the time. And then it resurfaced again in the early 2000s. And, you know, it's been ongoing since. So this is an example where it has been addressed, but, you know, it can resurface. So it's kind of like an ongoing conflict. So this is an example of an intrastate conflict. Another conflict that has resurfaced and, you know, is making the news at the moment is the Thai-Cambodian conflict, right? So it's a conflict that has been managed between two countries, but it hasn't been properly resolved, and hence this is why it resurfaced, right? And probably a lesser known conflict to the wider world that's not making the news so much, but the region is aware of this, is the Sabah dispute. So again, you know, it's the resurfacing from time to time of these old conflicts. So again, you know, I guess this highlights, on the surface, we do seem like a peaceful region. We're not constantly at war with one another, but we do have problems. And how can we better deal with these problems in the long run?
It's not a new conflict or new tension. It's an old conflict that resurface. Yeah, so it comes in cycle. Very interesting. And of course, when we talk about interstate conflict, it has very strong connection with domestic politics, with civil society engagement. I don't want to talk too much about the domestic politics, but I'm interested to know, to learn your view about civil society actors. You know, how could civil society actors, particularly minority groups, human rights activists, could push towards a non-violence or peace agenda in ASEAN? Do you see such role opening in Southeast Asia for civil society actors?
So first of all, I need to point out to the viewers that ASEAN is trying to move to a people-centered organization. Now, the reason, just to kind of like unpack this a bit, we've always, ASEAN has always been considered as an elite led organization, in the sense that, you know, decision making has been concentrated at the, you know, elite level and hasn't been inclusive of, you know, the people and all that. So this is why they want to move towards becoming a people-centered organization to be more inclusive of the region's population of 700 million people of, you know, different countries, diverse backgrounds and all that. Now, even though it started off as, you know, an elite organization, ASEAN has tried to engage with CSO since, if I remember correctly, 1979. Now, this is when, and I talk about this years because an accreditation system was introduced during that time, which allowed CSOs to become like ASEAN affiliated with ASEAN, right? So there are also official guidelines how relations between ASEAN and these organizations would how these would be conducted. So according to one report in 2004, only 72 CSOs signed up for this. So this is kind of like a, you know, small number in terms of how many CSOs, NGOs are working out there in the region and doing, you know, really, you know, contributions to different areas in society. So with that being said, even though there are these formal channels, I do, and you know, it hasn't been used too much, or it hasn't been utilized so much in that regard. You know, in terms of the accreditation system, I do feel that CSOs, academia, media can contribute to nonviolence in the sense that they can highlight problems, they can raise awareness. But at the end of the day, change does need to come from the governments, or you know, the member states, because the ASEAN system is quite different from the EU system in the sense of its relationship with member states and sovereignty and all that. So with the EU, it's a supranational organization. This means that member states give up some sovereignty to the EU, but ASEAN is the opposite. So the member states hold the authority. So it's the member states, the governments, that need to bring about change. CSOs, they can't do that, but they can raise awareness.
Then it's almost clear that the government, they always put national interest, national security above others, right? Then it's become difficult. But I like your remark saying that civil society, academics, journalists, the media, they can also play a role to push a non-violence agenda in ASEAN. You mentioned in ASEAN Charter, right, the idea of this regional grouping is to keep conflict away, to have peace and stability, then all the member countries could prosper. Also in your paper, you highlighted that that's not always the case. In our earlier conversation, you mentioned about some hurdles, some problems. But then I would like to ask you, how does nonviolence play out between and within Southeast Asian states?
ASEAN institutions and norms, as well as the expansion of economic interdependency throughout the region. And, you know, as I mentioned previously, the region is, you know, economically fast-growing region. And I think these elements together have prevented an outbreak of interstate war. So I think we have come a long way since the Cold War, when, you know, the region was divided between two ideological opposing blocks. However, these elements have not necessarily ensured democratic practices, especially at the domestic level or in terms of like diffusing into intrastate tensions. So, and you know, I think the main sticking point is the principle of non-interference, you know, which we talked about earlier. So the principle of non-interference places the authority on the individual states to determine how they respond to domestic level conflicts. So this could go either way. So you've got countries that are willing to introduce negotiations, democratic practices, for example, decentralization, to alleviate ethnic discontent. And I think a good example would be Indonesia. But you've got other countries that haven't been using these measures. And some go as far as, you know, violent suppression. So obviously, this goes against the principle of non-violence. But the question is, what is ASEAN doing about this? Is ASEAN doing its bit to kind of like remind countries that actually in the ASEAN Charter, we do need to respect differences?
I'd like to move to the next aspect of our region, which is ASEAN interaction with the non-ASEAN states. In particular, I would like to ask you about the South China Sea dispute. It continues, it grows more serious, especially during the sudden, how would you say, jump of global geopolitics. Yeah, it changed, it becomes much more intense. And of course, it's been affecting the South China Sea dispute. In your view, what makes it difficult for ASEAN to manage this conflict or this tension?
I would say that there are three complications in terms of the South China Sea dispute. So first of all, the South China Sea is marked by overlapping sovereignty claims by larger states, for example, you know, China, that's the most prominent, right? That has the military might and all that to, you know, achieve its goals. And then you've got other actors, for example, Taiwan, Malaysia, Brunei, Vietnam, the Philippines, so mostly Southeast Asian states. So and alongside these overlapping sovereignty claims, as you mentioned, Francie, so there's an intense struggle for influence between the major powers, so mainly the US and China. So you've got, you know, two levels of competition here. Now, an element of that complicates this further is the basis of sovereignty claims. So these differ, so which makes negotiations and conversations quite difficult. So China bases its claims on history. So and the Southeast Asian states, or the majority of states, they are mostly citing their claims based on UNCLOS, or the law of the sea. So this is the first complication. The second one is that not all ASEAN states are claimants in the South China Sea dispute. So the list of states just now are mostly archipelago Southeast Asian states. Oh, sorry, and I forgot to mention Indonesia. They have tensions with China, but they're not a claimant state. So the problem is China's claims overlap their EEC, or their exclusive economic zone, right? Mainly the Southeast Asian mainland states are not claimants to this dispute. Now, the consequences are that this has affected ASEAN unity in approaching the problem. This is quite problematic. Now, also complicating ASEAN's unity is that most of Southeast Asia consider China as an important economic and trading partner to varying degrees, right? And this further complicates the dynamics of ASEAN's unity. So you've got two levels of complications here. Now, how has this affected ASEAN? Well, definitely in the sense when ASEAN wants to issue a joint statement concerning the tensions within the South China Seas, sometimes the wording has been watered down. And in one particular instance, which, you know, is widely cited, is that ASEAN failed to come up with a statement after the 2012 summit. And that was the first time in its, you know, 50-year history. So that's something that this is a clear example where ASEAN unity has affected how we approach the problem. Now, the third problem, which is increasingly becoming a bigger problem, is that this area has been an area of increased and intense militarization. So you've got military buildup in terms of the major powers. You've got military buildup with the smaller states in Southeast Asia. You've got mini-lateralisms that, conduct military exercises in the South China Seas. So this negatively affects trust amongst Southeast Asian countries and China, but also China and the West, because the wider West is also involved in this. Now, despite all these challenges, I do believe that ASEAN remains the most viable mechanism for managing and containing the South China Sea dispute. And I do use the word containing because I don't think this can be properly resolved because of these overlapping claims and all that. Almost half of the members, ASEAN members, are claimant states. Okay, so this means that, you know, it makes sense that ASEAN to bring ASEAN into the management of this conflict. Secondly, ASEAN adopts an inclusive diplomatic approach. It hasn't excluded China, and this is quite different from the mini-lateral frameworks that are being established by the West. Third, China hasn't entirely rejected ASEAN's role. So at least if we keep this forum for as a lines of communication between the parties, I think that could contain the prospect of military clashes. I'm not saying that there haven't been, but at least it can reduce the temperature of the problem.
A follow-up question on this issue. We mentioned about big powers, major powers in the world, right? You mentioned China, the West, US, and other middle power that has, let's say, relations with ASEAN member states. Then we can also say that conflicts in the region, intrastate or interstate conflict, are influenced by big powers. In your opinion, how can ASEAN as an institution keep its unity and avoid being pushed to take sides?
Well, first of all, I think we need to look at on a case-by-case basis because, you know, not conflicts, all conflicts are the same, and, you know, it's hard to generalize and all that. But what I do see, and this coming from a mainland Southeast Asian state, so Thailand is a mainland Southeast Asian state, I think it's really important for ASEAN to get behind, member states' problems. You know, to feel that, you know, we have each other's back. So just to expand on this, ASEAN has had a considerable role in the South China Sea, right? For decades, basically. And, you know, it's trying to negotiate this conflict management mechanism, which is the code of conduct, the COC, in which, you know, we can manage relations with China and all that. So we're negotiating this with China. However, we also have another problem with China, which hasn't been talked so much within ASEAN forums, and that's the Mekong subregion. So for the viewers who are not familiar with this problem, the Mekong is a river that runs through China. It starts in China and then runs through Southeast Asian countries, mainly the mainland Southeast Asian countries. This river is an important source it's important for many groups and communities, especially rice growing communities and all that. But because it hasn't reached or been talked about in ASEAN forums, mainland Southeast Asian countries have dealt with it outside the ASEAN framework. So, you know, it just feels that, you know, some feel that the archipelago states aren't with us with this problem, but we are behind the archipelago states in this with the South China Sea. So I think we need to kind of like feel that we have one another's back. I think that would contribute to unity, but also, you know, there are other problems as well. You know, it is quite a difficult question. So I think the main thing is to kind of like talk on a case-by-case basis.
In your paper, you give a good overview, recommendation, all the issues are identified with the hope that one day nonviolence would work, because the title is When Nonviolence Fails, right? So you started with a bit pessimist tone in the beginning. My last question to you, what be your main points for recommendation towards establishing an ASEAN who adopt nonviolence agenda, and also to provide inclusive peace for everybody?
Okay, so I guess this question kind of like sums up, you know, our conversation from the start to the beginning. So I think ASEAN's role has been focused on interstate peace, right? Interstate stability and all that. And the principle of non-interference has played a strong role in this. And, you know, as we've talked throughout, you know, we've come a long way since the Cold War. And yes, there have been problems between Thailand and Cambodia. But let me put it this way. If there wasn't the ASEAN framework, would have conflict gone on? So, you know, that relationship through ASEAN networks, diplomacy and all that has contributed to regional relations, definitely, right? However, you know, when we talk about interstate peace, right, we're specifically talking about, you know, governments and all that, but people who are experiencing wars, they say, well, you know, what about our peace? What about our security and all that? And so this, so the principle of non-interference has done its bit already. Now, is it time for us to rethink this principle? And do we need to adapt with the times and consider peace, security, for the peoples? And as, you know, the ASEAN Charter mentions, we're supposed to be moving towards a people-centered community. And can't we place an emphasis on that rather than the principle of non-interference, which is keeping peace between countries?
Thank you, Professor Dr. Chanintira Natalang, for speaking to us today and for sharing your valuable insight with our audiences. And stay tuned for the next episode of Bull Talks, Dialogues and Insights from Southeast Asia, where we continue exploring the ideas, people, and stories driving change across Southeast Asia.